From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, New York Times reporters Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey join us. They're the reporters who exposed the Harvey Weinstein scandal, the story credited with triggering the Me Too movement that also won a Pulitzer Prize. Toohey and Cantor have written a behind-the-scenes account of how they reported the story, and they've introduced us to the women who came forward to say they've been sexually harassed or assaulted by Harvey Weinstein. The book is called She Said. Join our conversation after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When New York Times reporters Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey published their first story on Harvey Weinstein in October of 2017, they were stunned by the reaction. More stories began pouring into the Times of rape, sexual harassment, and abuse by powerful men. And this time, the public seemed to care. But what's clear from their new book, She Said, about how they pieced together the Weinstein story, is that this story would have never seen the light of day. There were so many reasons that this story might not have been published. In exposing the accusations against Weinstein, Cantor and Toohey exposed a system that silences women and enables perpetrators that was very invested in staying hidden. Jody Cantor, Megan Toohey, welcome to Forum.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And the title of your book, Megan Toohey, She Said, it really struck me because it evokes the he said, she said, the very thing that an investigative story is trying to avoid. So talk a little bit about what's behind the decision to make the title She Said.
Well, there are multiple layers to the title She Said. You know, this book includes some of the women who did, in fact, go on the record in our first Weinstein story and the wrenching decisions that they faced as they determined whether or not they were going to be able to make that leap. It also tells the story of women who were silenced, especially through secret settlements that have been used, not just in the case of Weinstein, but in sexual harassment and sexual assault cases across the country. You know, women basically being told that their best option is to take money in exchange for silence. So when a reporter comes knocking on her door, that woman is legally prohibited from speaking out. And then we also push into the story of Christine Blasey Ford. We don't stop this book with publishing the Weinstein story in 2017. We push into the year that followed as the Me Too movement took off and became more complicated and brought with it all these confusing questions. And we piece together the behind-the-scenes story of Christine Blasey Ford's private path to testifying in Washington. We really came to see hers as being one of the most complicated, she said, cases that we had ever seen. So it actually is meant to mean a variety of things that we want to share with the readers.
Yes, the most complicated, she said, story. That's such an interesting point. I think the other thing, Jody Cantor, that it brought up for me is that even though we, or at least in the media, it's painted that he said, she said, that both parties are on equal footing through that sort of framing, that in reality, even if there's the he said side of the story and the she said side of the story, there's still a power differential that's existing in that just because of social systems and gender structures in this country.
And so much of the reporting of the Weinstein story was about grappling with that problem behind the scenes. You know, this book is an invitation into our partnership and into our process. And we're taking you behind the scenes on those first hushed phone calls with actresses. We're going to introduce you to Erwin Ryder, who's kind of the deep throat of the Harvey Weinstein investigation, Weinstein's accountant of 30 years, and a he, by the way, who really helped with the story. And part of what we're taking you through is the process of building a mountain of evidence. The first story we published about Weinstein, there were two brave women who were on the record, but it was also personnel records. It was the legal and financial trail of the settlements. It was stuff from human resources at the Weinstein Company. It was other former Weinstein employees saying, yes, this was a big problem at the company. So everybody knows about the kind of public drama that played out when the Weinstein stories were published. This is the behind-the-scenes drama of how do you take that secret and bring it to light?
And the other part of this that you really exposed was just the systematic way that women are silenced through these non-disclosure agreements, through these secret settlements. And I was wondering if you could just talk about what some of these settlements contain, besides the fact that they were a payout to the women who were assaulted for their silence.
Yeah, I think that there's no question that there's no question that women who are victimized, who suffer sexual harassment and sexual assault, I don't think anybody would be surprised or even have problems with those women receiving financial damages for what they've experienced. But in the course of reporting this book, we realized that these secret settlements that are paid out come with outrageous restrictive clauses. Women can't tell their husbands, they can't tell their colleagues if they want to see a therapist. The therapist has to sign a confidentiality clause. And in the case of alleged predators like Harvey Weinstein, they've really served as a tool that has allowed them to cover their tracks and go on to allegedly hurt more people. In the case of Weinstein, we were able to identify as many as 12 secret settlements that have been paid out, stretching from 1990 to 2015.
And one of those settlements was with a woman who is in the Bay Area now. Her name is Rowena Chu. And one of the things that struck me about her experience, besides just the assault on her, but also the settlement process, that it was this incredibly grueling, exhausting overnight process, and then the language that was in it as well. Can you share what some of the requirements were in Chu's particular settlement? Jody Kantor.
Sure. So part of what is so fascinating about Rowena is that even as the Weinstein story broke here in the Bay Area, I think that most people did not suspect that there was a hardworking mom living in Silicon Valley named Rowena Chu, who in fact was a key Weinstein victim who had been pursued by journalists for about 15 years. And part of the reason she's so central to the Weinstein story is exactly what you're saying. The amount of cover-up and the severity of her settlement was really striking. At the Times, we've been studying these settlements for a long time. Our colleagues looked at them in the Bill O'Reilly case, in the Larry Nassar case. They've been used to silence. Women sign them, frankly, across the country every single day. But we have never seen one quite like the one belonging to Rowena Chu and her colleague Zelda Perkins in the UK.
Wasn't one of the requirements that she couldn't even, besides not even sharing the story, they couldn't even say anything negative about Harvey Weinstein?
They basically couldn't discuss their experience at Miramax at all. Here's an example. They were not allowed to retain a copy of their own settlement agreement because that could have been construed as some sort of evidence. And so actually, I tried to talk to Rowena in the summer of 2017, and she wouldn't answer my calls. She wouldn't return my emails. She was taking her commitment to this settlement very seriously, which you're supposed to do. And so finally, I showed up in her driveway. It's an awkward part of reporting, but sometimes a necessary one. And her husband was home. And it turns,
yes, she was not.
She was not home, and her husband was kind enough to speak to me for a few minutes off the record in the driveway. But it quickly became a very awkward conversation because he did not know his own wife's story. She had never told him, in part because the settlement really is a promise and an exchange of money not to. And so we're very happy to say that Rowena has now gone on the record in this book. She actually wrote a stunning account of her own experience that was published in the Times last Sunday. And I'm happy to say that I think we're going to get to speak to her live tonight. We're doing an event at City Arts and Lectures, and Rowena has generously agreed to answer a couple of questions on stage. So that is a pretty dramatic journey to go from 20 years of silence to answering questions live on stage.
And that event at City Arts and Lectures is at 7:30 tonight. Megan Tuohy, the other thing that's so striking about Rowena Chu's experience is that you realize that there is this whole other category of women that Harvey Weinstein victimized, not just actresses in his films, and I don't want to say just, but that he also allegedly preyed upon on young, ambitious women trying to you be producers, get into the film industry at Miramax?
It was a significant development in the course of our reporting to realize that he had allegedly targeted women ranging from Gwyneth Paltrow to women who had served as assistants in his companies. These were oftentimes their first jobs out of college. They were coming in. Working for Harvey Weinstein was often seen as, you know, your sort of first and prominent entrance into the entertainment industry. He was a very powerful gatekeeper. And what we realized was that oftentimes he basically turned those ambitions, all of those work ambitions, against these women. So, you know, even going back to 1990, there was a woman that we consider to be the patient zero of the Weinstein investigation. She had been, I tracked her down to a home outside of Manhattan in New York, knocked on her door. This was a woman who had been an assistant in Miramax in the early 90s, and when she was allegedly sexually assaulted by the boss, and she disappeared from the company and basically disappeared from the industry. And when I found her outside, at this home outside New York, you know, she said, "I've been waiting for this knock on my door for 25 years." But she had also been silenced through a secret settlement and was not in a position to talk. But it was a real key moment when we realized that there had been victims, not just in, you know, not just actresses, but also his own employees stretching back decades.
And there were the employees that he victimized, but also the employees who were aware of this behavior. I felt like there were a couple of categories. There were the people that were aware and would tell new employees things like, don't sit on a couch in an armchair, because that way this person cannot come up to you. Wear a heavy coat in his presence, as opposed to any clothing that can easily be removed. Even Rowena Chu talks about wearing double tights because that's what she was advised to do. So clearly people were aware of this. So there was a whole system of awareness. And then there was an even bigger level of complicity, people who actually aided him, Jodi Kantor, in this pursuit of predation. I have no other way of describing it.
This is the moral horror of the Harvey Weinstein story. How could a man have accumulated over 40 years worth of allegations and nobody stopped him? As Megan just mentioned, the woman Megan was just describing is sort of the patient zero of the Weinstein investigation, and her story is from 1990. And there was a whole legal process. There was a settlement. There's evidence that Bob Weinstein, Harvey's brother and his business partner, knew about that settlement. And so, I mean, actually, I think we should talk a little bit about Bob Weinstein, because he is, I think, one of the greatest case studies in what you're asking about. He refused to talk to us in our initial – we called him shortly after the Weinstein story broke. He would like slam down the phone on Megan. But Megan, do you want to talk a little bit about what happened when you actually sat down with him to ask what he knew and how he thought about it and whether – he felt he should have done more?
Yeah, we really felt like it was one of the most pressing questions. What did Bob Weinstein know? When did he know it? And what did he try to do about it? And so eventually he did open up to a series of interviews. You know, he and Harvey Weinstein ran two companies together for over 30 years, first Miramax and the Weinstein Company. And he acknowledged that he was aware of sexual misconduct allegations against his brother going back to the 90s. And that in two of the cases, he was actually the one who provided the money that silenced Rowena Chu and Zelda Perkins. He said that, like so many other people, he chose to believe his brother when Weinstein insisted that these were all extramarital affairs and nothing more. And in the case of Bob Weinstein, he also had suffered from and then recovered from substance abuse, and so actually made the sort of moral mistake of viewing his brother's behavior as sex addiction. So he provided us with this letter that he wrote to Harvey Weinstein in 2015, 2 years before everything spilled out into the public view, in which he's pleading with him to get treatment for quote-unquote misbehavior. And we include that letter in its entirety. I mean, the letter did not solve the problem, but we include it as an example of, like, when any of us get glimpses of wrongdoing, whether it's a family member or colleague, what do we try to do? How do you try to intervene? And how is it that you can become complicit in abuse?
Yes, sort of your attempt to rationalize it, mm-hmm. as well, to some extent. As you use the word the horrors of the Harvey Weinstein story, and there are so many horrors on so many levels, and we can all see now why this story would grab people's attention. But as you were reporting it, I mean, there were significant doubts, right, that people would care even once you published this story. I remember this incredible moment in your book when you talk about your editor saying, Harvey Weinstein isn't that famous.
Well, what that editor was doing, Matt Purdy, is he was stress testing the story, which is a good thing to do. That was a productive thing to do because with any investigative story, any big story in the Times, you want to be your own toughest critic and say, why? Hey, people might not care about this. You know, do we have to make the case that people should care about this, et cetera, et cetera? And there was definitely a worry that it would be perceived as like, oh, sleazy Hollywood producer, you know, has questionable behavior towards women. And in fact, early in the reporting, we would get these lectures from jaded Hollywood executives. Some of them were former Miramax employees or others. And they would say things, you know, you listen to a lot of lecturing as a reporter and a lot of people telling you that your story is not a story. And by the way, some of these were women. And they would say things like, oh, Jody, you know, you don't really understand our industry. The casting couch is just part of Hollywood. It's very unfortunate, but it's embedded in the business. You know, it's sort of structural to the way things work. And, you know, they were kind of right. Like, there was actually a casting couch statue in Los Angeles, like near those famous old Chinese theaters where they do movie premieres. And they would say, even if you manage to land your story, nobody will care because everybody knows that Harvey does this, and this is just how the business works.
And so do you have some insight now on why you think it caught fire the way that it did? I remember reading at one point that you were also concerned that maybe people wouldn't necessarily have that much empathy for these actresses because they were famous and they have a lot of power. And so, you know, the woe is me might not be there. But then ultimately, in your book, it seemed to suggest that it was actually the fact that people felt like they knew those actresses, like the role that they play as actors makes us feel like, we know you, you're part of us, we were moved by you. And so hearing that these things happened to you moved us as well.
I will confess when I actually started, Jody was the first to start the Weinstein investigation. And when I came on board, right after I came back from maternity leave, I myself was actually doubtful. I struggled to grasp the idea of some of these famous actresses like Gwyneth Paltrow being victims. It just was, as investigative reporters, one of the things we do is we sort of seek ways to give voice to the voiceless. And it was just tough for me to wrap my head around this idea of these famous actresses as being victims and in need of the type of investigative reporting that we do. But Jody actually convinced me. She said, listen, if this is happening to these women, it suggests that nobody is immune. And so I think that was actually one of the things that was so striking when the story finally broke, was that this was a reminder that this could happen to anybody. And what we also realized, and it was that this was a story that went beyond an individual alleged predator, that the story was so much bigger than Harvey Weinstein, that it was really an X-ray into abuse of power and the machinery that was in place to silence women.
Certainly that machinery. We're talking with New York Times reporters Megan Toohey and Jody Kantor, who broke the Harvey Weinstein story in October of 2017. Their new book, She Said, gives a behind-the-scenes account of their reporting of the story that helped ignite the Me Too movement. And what are your questions for Megan Toohey and Jody Kantor? What impact did the Weinstein story have on you? The Blasey Ford story, the Me Too movement. What are your questions about investigative reporting? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on Facebook, on Twitter, at KQED Forum, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. One of the things that was really incredible about what you included in this book that was not known before was the relationship of Gloria Allred and her daughter to the Weinstein story. And of course, Gloria Allred has she's known for being a famous feminist attorney, and her daughter Lisa also represented victims of sexual assault as well. So can you describe this discovery that you made, Jodi Kantor, that they were involved in actually helping Harvey Weinstein?
But in two totally different ways, yeah. I think. But like they were both sort of acts of concealment, but in radically different ways that I think illustrate two totally different aspects of the story. So let's take Gloria Allred first, you know, probably the most famous feminist attorney in the U.S. I mean, known for talking about women raising their voices and being willing to fight. And, you know, she strikes a very sort of uncompromising pose on the public stage. So it turns out that Gloria Allred does a really significant business in these secret settlements we were just talking about, this sort of money for silence deal where a woman agrees not to speak about her experiences and she gets financial recompense. And Allred and her firm can take as much as 40% of the money. Now, first of all, there are many reasons why a woman may choose to do this, which I think we were talking about a second ago. It does preserve your privacy. You do get the money. It is an easier way of moving on. It is totally true that going to court is very difficult. The question is really whether the confidentiality provisions have to be as strict as the ones that Allred and her firm have done over the years. And in fact, California has started to modify the rules around this, because what we see with Allred is that she also did a settlement in the Bill O'Reilly case. Her firm did one in the Larry Nassar case. And these settlements, they conceal the problem. They mean that nobody knows. They mean that an alleged perpetrator can go on to do the same thing. Lisa Bloom played a whole other role in this story. We included a lot of documents in this book, so you can sort of see them firsthand.
Yes.
And one of the things we have is Lisa Bloom's job audition memo for Harvey Weinstein, where in late 2016, she says, I'm going to take all my fame and credibility as a feminist attorney. I'm going to take my experience representing these women, and I'm going to cross over to your side and deploy that. And this memo says, I will lie on your behalf. I will smear on your behalf. I will manipulate on your behalf. And she lays out this very elaborate multi-step plan to basically discredit Rose McGowan, a Weinstein accuser. And she does so with language that really makes you question sort of how she does business generally. She says something like, I've dealt with a lot of roses of the world. I've represented a lot of roses of the world. And they start out as these impressive women. But the more you press, the weaknesses and lies are revealed.
Well, we're getting some interesting comments around these NDA agreements. And so we're going to take those questions after this break. You're listening to Forum.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're joined by New York Times reporters Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, who won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on the Harvey Weinstein scandal. In their new book, She Said, it's been compared to All the President's Men, and it's called a how-to on investigative journalism. It introduces us to the women who came forward at great risk to share their stories of assault and abuse by Weinstein, and it examines how the Me Too movement has changed in the 2 years since the scandal broke. And we're taking your questions, listeners, for Megan Toohey and Jodi Kantor. So the number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. And the place to post your comments, Facebook, Twitter, our website, or email them to us at forum@kqed.org. And Julie asks, what are the legal consequences if someone who signs a non-disclosure agreement does disclose the events they're not supposed to?
Well,
Megan Toohey.
It's a really good question. And for so long, women just victims did not break these confidentiality clauses, did not break out of their secret settlements. So we're just now starting to see some of the ramifications. It really depends on what the alleged perpetrator decides to do. These the way that they are structured is that if somebody does break them, the other individual can come after them for all the money that's been paid, as well as financial penalties. So it is a very – these things are no joke. And one of the things that women have to weigh is whether or not they're prepared to suffer those financial consequences in order to speak out. Harvey Weinstein has not – as of yet, not come after any of the women who broke their secret settlements. He threatened to, but he has not followed through. But you know, he is also facing criminal trial in New York.
Yes.
It's been
scheduled for when January.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's. I think he's focused on other things. But there have been other cases of people bringing, you know, pulling people into secret arbitration to seek financial damages in these cases.
One thing to just clarify is that there are actually two kinds of NDAs. There's the kind Megan's talking about, which are involved in these legal settlements, these complex legal transactions that result from some sort of a dispute. But there are also your sort of everyday company NDAs. And I think there are a lot of companies in the Bay Area, including tech companies, that have people sign these as a matter of course. Those we have a slightly different attitude towards those as reporters. People break them all the time to speak to us for stories. We can never promise somebody that they won't face legal consequences. But generally what lawyers say is that those kinds of standard company NDAs are rarely enforced, especially if somebody's talking about something like sexual abuse to a newspaper. They're almost meant to intimidate. It's very, very rare that they're enforced.
Well, I'd like to get your reaction to listener Wendy's comment. Wendy writes, "Any woman who takes a secret settlement is allowing perpetrators to continue to prey on women. I have no respect for women who take a monetary settlement but sign a non-disclosure agreement. I wonder how it's even legal to do this."
Well, I mean, we understand how people can have that these secret settlements can inspire strong feelings in people. But in our experience, coming across women who have signed them over the years, what's clear is that this really is often presented as the best, if not the only, realistic option. When a woman comes forward, in a lot of these cases, women will turn to their attorneys because they want to do something about what's just happened to them. They want to hold that person accountable. And, you know, they are told, and these oftentimes these lawyers aren't lying, that if they were to go to court, that there'd be no guarantees that they would basically receive any financial damages for what they had experienced, that they would, in the process of going public, be dragged through the mud and, you know, called basically they could, you know, suffer sort of smears and other types of attacks by the alleged perpetrator. And that, you know, these, you know, to be able to accept these secret settlements is really the best and only thing that they can do. And so I think that there's now some women have decided that have said that they feel like they made a mistake and are willing to break them now. But I really think that this is that if we're going to examine these secret settlements, we should be looking at how these alleged perpetrators have used them. Let's keep the attention on them. And the way that they've used them as tools in their sort of alleged predation and covering their tracks. But let's also just examine this broader system. Let's look at the attorneys who have participated in this, sometimes taking home as much as a 40% cut, as Gloria Allred's firm did in the case of one of these Weinstein secret settlements.
Well, speaking of attorneys, there's a very well-known attorney here, David Boies, because he was a hero of the marriage equality Supreme Court case and held in very high regard. And then we learn from your paper that he ended up being one of Weinstein's biggest defenders who worked hard to stop your story, Jody Kantor, while his firm was working for the New York Times.
I really relate to your question because I remember seeing David Boies walk down the street, I think at a gay pride parade in San Francisco right here, right after that big legal victory. I'm pretty sure he was part of that parade. So yes, it is extremely surprising that one of the most renowned litigators in the country, one often associated with liberal causes, turns out to have been perhaps Harvey Weinstein's one of his most steadfast defenders. There are a couple of really remarkable things about David Boies's role in this. One is the duration. It was about a 15-year legal relationship from about 2002 to about 2017. So during that whole time, we have been able to prove that David Boies was deflecting, spinning, minimizing, silencing. These allegations were coming up again and again every couple of years, and Boies was constantly helping to hide them. So if you look at the number of women, if we go back to the 80-plus women who have come forward about Weinstein, a lot of those claims were between 2002 and 2017. So who else was allegedly getting hurt while he was protecting this guy? I think the other thing that is really remarkable is the kind of role that he played. Even when he was talking to us about Weinstein, he would often say things to the Times like, oh, I don't want to participate in this as Harvey's lawyer. You know, I'm just his friend. But then in sort of defending his role in the Weinstein case, he would say things like, I was his lawyer. I was just trying to do a good job of protecting my client. So those are very contradictory things to say. I think they raise ethical questions about the limits you can go to as a lawyer in defending your client. And then the last thing is that other figures, including Lisa Bloom, have apologized deeply, repeatedly for their roles in the Weinstein affair. And part of what was remarkable, I think, about Megan's interview with Boies for this book is that he really did not express regret.
And we go to more calls. Let me go to Anna in Oakland. Hi, Anna.
Hello. I want to say thank you to Jody and Megan. You've inspired a lot of people to come forward. And my question is related to kind of the secret settlement. So do you feel like if a victim is already marginalized, let's say having less power, like similarly in like the Matt Lawler case, do you believe that if they're already marginalized, then the secret settlements prey upon that unequal power dynamic and that sort of space between protection of the victim? A lot of times the courts, statutes of limitations run out by the time victims come forward, or the trauma has been so great that they've disassociated or compartmentalized. And just what kind of role do you think that plays, and what can victims do who don't want to enter mediation, who feel pressured and don't necessarily have the social capital because maybe they're low income, maybe they're of color, maybe they're women of color, maybe they're undocumented. What type of resources do you suggest to those women who don't think that secret settlements will benefit them and would like accountability?
Anna, thanks.
Yeah, Anna, and I think, I mean, the answer is yes. I do think that these secret settlements are sort of a byproduct of and help sort of extend oftentimes the power differentials that we see in these cases time and time again. For example, we were one of the secret settlements that Weinstein paid was in 2004 to a young woman, Ashley Mathew, who had been a backup dancer in one of his movies when he showed up on set and pressured her into a sort of meeting in a hotel room in which he allegedly sexually assaulted her. You know, she came back to Los Angeles, where she lived, and immediately sought help from Gloria Allred's firm, and ended up in a meeting with her lawyer seated across from Harvey Weinstein and his powerful attorney, Dan Petrocelli, who's also one of the most powerful lawyers in the country. And as she tells it, you know, even the notion that she was going to go public, they said, you know, if you go public, we're going to drag you through the mud by your hair. And so she really felt like to go up against somebody as powerful as Harvey Weinstein and his lawyer, one of the most powerful lawyers in the country, was just a power differential that she couldn't bear. She felt like she was just going to be completely destroyed in the process, and believed her attorney when he said, listen, I don't think that you'll be able to handle it. I really do think that this secret settlement is your best option. So in terms of like what the alternatives are, I mean, the alternative is to, you know, you can file a complaint with the EEOC and sort of start down the civil court system that handles sexual harassment complaints in open courts of law. Although even there, sometimes these settlements, those often will also result in secret out-of-court settlements. You know, if there's an alleged crime that's happened, you can go to the criminal justice system. But I think that what we've seen in the course of our reporting is that these secret settlements are actually an indication that some of these other channels are not necessarily working and that the laws are not adequate. So that really they really bring to light a lot of other questions about what more systemic reforms need to take place to make sure that everybody's adequately protected.
Anna, thanks for your question. You know, one of the things Anna's making me think about is also just what sounds like a constant stream of phone calls, stories, questions that you get now as a result of having reported on the Weinstein story and also on other major cases of sexual assault. And reporting just on the topic alone and talking with potential victims about such traumatic experiences creates a certain kind of relationship with your source that is different from just a straight news story, Jody Kantor. And I was wondering just how you've managed those kinds of relationships post-publishing the Harvey Weinstein piece. And not only that, but what it feels like a tidal wave, not that you weren't aware of it before, but a tidal wave of women who have had this experience.
It's a great question. We are very close to our sources, but it's a very unusual relationship. We're not their friends. We're not their therapists. We're not their advocates. Our job is to bring their stories to light, and it's a professional relationship. And the relationships, by the way, are the same, whether they're famous actresses or not. We've brought Gwyneth Paltrow, Ashley Judd and Angelina Jolie on the record. We've brought Rowena Chu on the record. We've brought, you know, a whole bunch of Weinstein assistants whose names are not well known on the record. And it's really the same because it involves the kind of patience and empathy that you would expect, but also a certain toughness, because our goal is to protect everybody by reporting with the most rigor we can. What you do not want in these situations is something like the infamous Rolling Stone story set at the University of Virginia, where it was a campus rape story where it turns out the facts really did not stand up to scrutiny and the story collapsed and it set back the cause of campus sexual assault, you know, added to the argument that, you know, women make up these stories. It was an incredibly painful episode. So I'll share a memory from the summer of 2017, we were meeting Gwyneth Paltrow for the first time, and I had heard her story, and I brought Megan to meet her, and that was sort of the pretext. But Megan was asking her to essentially repeat the story in part to see whether she told it exactly the same way, and she was very consistent. And one of the things we ask all our sources for is we need some sort of corroboration. We try to find out who else they told at the time. So the person she told at the time was Brad Pitt. So Megan just looked at her and said, okay, we're going to need to contact Brad Pitt. And it was like just, you know, total business as usual. But there is, I think, part of the closeness comes from once you're sure that somebody has a very strong story, wanting to protect them through the process. Going on the record is really scary for everybody, no matter who you are. And the age of the internet and social media only makes it scarier. And so especially around the time of publication, we are keeping in constant touch with these women. What happened after we published the story is that so many women came to us and our colleagues at the Times that we did not know what to do. And it's frankly 2 years later still happening every day. The messages are coming in on the phone, email, through Instagram, through Facebook, and it's more stories than we could ever tell. Journalism is not a volume business. It sometimes takes us 6 months to do a single story well. And so we want people to feel that this story is about the power of journalism to create social change, but it's also about the limits of journalism, because even though this has become sort of a team project across journalism in this country, we cannot tell all of these stories. Journalism stepped in when other systems failed, but it's not a substitute for other systems working in a healthy way.
I'm struck, Megan Twohey, by Jody bringing up protection, because I remember there was one point in the book when you asked the New York Times what they could do for one of your sources if Harvey Weinstein came after that particular source, and they were basically like, nothing. Yeah. Well, we can't. Right. We can only go so far. But my other question is, the other thing that struck me as you were trying to gather these stories was that a lot of these women were saying that they would come forward if a lot of other women came forward. And at the same time, there's also this sort of social requirement that if we do a sexual assault story, that there need to be other victims in addition to one victim that this person may have assaulted, right? Do you think we're any closer to one story being enough to publish?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I think that one of the things that we have found as journalists is really significant about patterns of alleged predation is that, listen, I think that there is every single account of sexual harassment, every single account of sexual assault matters. It's important. As journalists, there's only so many stories that we can cover. And I think that one of the reasons that we have felt really strongly about pursuing stories that involved alleged predation that's ongoing is because it really takes the moral stakes of those investigations are even higher, because this was something that Jody and I realized in the course of our reporting. At first, we were piecing together allegations from the 1990s, and then several months into our investigation, we were able to identify alleged harassment and assault that had played out in 2014, 2015. And it was the moment that we realized that if we weren't able to publish the truth, that this person was – that Harvey Weinstein was fairly likely going to go on to be able to continue to hurt more women. And so we felt like if we couldn't publish the truth, if we couldn't stop him, we were actually going to be sort of watching a public danger continue to operate unchecked.
Again, we're talking with Megan Twohey and Jody Kantor about their new book, She Said, a behind-the-scenes account of the reporting on the story of Harvey Weinstein that helped ignite the Me Too movement. Jody Kantor, why not stop at the Weinstein story? I mean, you could have made this book entirely about your reporting process for Weinstein, but you decided to continue the story with Christine Blasey Ford, who accused Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault when she was in high school with him.
It would have been too easy to stop with Weinstein. It wouldn't have reflected the complexity and the controversy that so many people are feeling about Me Too. Look, Me Too is an example of social change in our time, and it's a test of social change in our time. Are all of us together going to be able to formulate a new compact for how we treat one another? We think there are basically, when we look at like the flaming ball of controversy that sometimes engulfs these Me Too stories, we think it comes from the merging of three questions that we actually want to separate. Number one, what's the scope of behavior under scrutiny? Are we only talking about classic harassment and assault, or are we talking about verbal abuse? How far back do we go in time? That's question number one. Question number two is, what's the process for figuring out what happened and establishing the facts? We know what it is in our office, but it's not the same everywhere. Number three, what does accountability look like? It's really easy to insist on accountability. It's much harder to actually assign it. And so when we saw the emergence of the Christine Blasey Ford story, we thought this story encapsulates all – it's going to force us to struggle with all three of these questions. And so essentially what we did is – This is the behind-the-scenes story of Christine Blasey Ford's path to that unforgettable Senate testimony, because we all remember that testimony so well. But as Megan learned during many, many hours of reporting with Dr. Ford, the path to that testimony was so complicated, filled with contradictions, with tough choices, with a kind of escalating series of forces that all came to bear on this one woman. And we wanted people to understand what had really happened.
Do you think that part of why ultimately Christine Blasey Ford's story didn't stop his ascent to the U.S. Supreme Court was because at that time there seemed to be this current asking the question of whether the Me Too reckoning had gone too far, Megan Toohey?
Yeah, there's no question that by the time she showed up in Washington, there was already kind of a mounting backlash and a sense by some people in the country that the Me Too movement had gone too far, that absent, you know, answers to the questions that Jody just spelled out, that there was – that we were sort of in the Wild West and that there weren't adequate reforms that had been in place to protect both accusers and the accused. I think there was actually frustration, as Jody and I document, in that year that followed. There was frustration on both sides, people who felt like change had gone too far and people who felt like change had not gone far enough. And so, you know, Christine Blasey Ford entered the sort of public arena amid that mounting confusion and frustration. And what we have found time and again is that when allegations are made in a political setting, that it quickly descends into holy war. You know, this book actually starts with the reporting that I did on women who came forward with allegations against Trump in 2016, which was also an example of how these things can become, once they're made in this political setting, so completely polarizing. So I think that that played out in the Kavanaugh case. It was basically like you were pouring political gasoline onto what had already been this mounting confusion and frustration. And so there, you know, we're going to be figuring out, I think we're going to be figuring out for months and years what the implications of that particular case was. But what we can tell you is that, you know, back to Rowena Chu, one of the last things we did as part of our reporting was to bring together women who had been, for a group interview here in California in January, women who had been part of our reporting on Trump, people who had been part of the Weinstein investigation, and Christine Blasey Ford. And that was really a moment where Rowena Chu said, like, looked at Christine Blasey Ford and said, you know, was so inspired by what she had done. Yes, it had been messy. Yes, it had been difficult. But she was so inspired that it really became one of her factors in deciding to finally go on the record.
Well, let me go back to our listeners. Rajiv in Berkeley, join us.
Hey, thank you for your work. You mentioned that California is moving to curb some of these NDA challenges. It would be great to hear a little bit more. And do you believe that it's possible to do something legislatively that patterns of abuse like these don't go undetected? You know, whether it's through exclusion of a class of abuses from certain kinds of agreements or require registration with the state.
Rajiv, thanks. Megan or Jody?
So I think the origin of the California law actually has to do with child sexual abuse and the idea that that could not be kept secret through a settlement. And then it was expanded slightly. And I think the emphasis is on cases that are filed in court and that, you know, essentially those can't be kept entirely secret. So it's a modification of the law. It's not a whole scale change. But as far as your question about legislation, it's really interesting. And I think about this sometimes when I look at the Democratic field of candidates, because I think, you know, okay, if one of them is elected president and if Democratic legislation actually begins to move in Washington, would anything change on the federal level? Because what we can tell you is that federal sexual harassment laws are shockingly weak. If you're a freelancer, you're not protected. If you work for a business that has fewer than 15 employees, you are not protected. As we've seen actually play out in some Bay Area cases like the Ellen Pao case, it is incredibly hard to win one of these cases in court. So I think you're asking a great question, which is, do we need a federal system of stronger protections?
We just have a couple minutes left, and I want to ask both of you why you choose to report on these stories. You both have a large folder, portfolio of stories, and you stay on this topic. And I could understand it, you know, from the level of, you know, the intensities of the stories, the power and the abuse, the structures that you uncover. But I just want to know why personally you're drawn to these kinds of stories. Megan, too.
Well, I would say that, you know, as investigative reporters, you know, our job is to basically look for abuse of power. And I think that, you know, I began covering, doing stories about sex crimes in Chicago years ago, women who had submitted to rape kits that were placed in police storage and never tested, women who had been victimized by their doctors, sex abusing doctors. And what I found time and again was that what was just as outrageous, which was, these were oftentimes women who had been violated twice, first by the alleged perpetrator and then by the system that looked the other way when they sought help, whether it was police and prosecutors or medical regulators. In the case of Weinstein, we were looking at, you know, companies that were complicit in abuse. And I think that in the machinery that was in place, the high price lawyers that basically swooped in to help cover Weinstein's tracks. And I think that one of the things for me, I mean, I just can't imagine, to me, it just all kind of merged into what I have really come to see as one of the most egregious abuses of power.
Jody Kantor, 20 seconds.
Because this matters to everybody. So much of investigative journalism is about locked away corporate or government secrets. This is about all of us.
Jody Kantor, Megan Toohey, thanks both of you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Their book is She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story that helped ignite a movement. Thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. And from all of us here at Forum, have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.